This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
January 26th, 2019. This is Deanna Spingola, and I'm broadcasting from the very frigid Chicago suburbs. I went out this morning. Well, actually, it was just about 11 o'clock, and it was 7 degrees. So hopefully you are in a warmer, hopefully where you're at is quite a bit warmer, and I do appreciate you joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. Excuse me. I invite you to visit and subscribe to SpingolaSpeaks.net and ScreeningSandyHook.net. During the program, email questions or comments to comment@Spingola.email. Please visit our very friendly chat room at spingola.chatango.com. Well, it is friendly. We do have trolls once in a while, so anyway, just a warning. You may view our past, current, and future guest lineup at spingola.com, where you will find the calendar and the schedule, excuse me, all the way back to October 23rd, 2010. Just visit spingola.com, click on the radio schedule button on the left, choose the year and the month. Excuse me. My guest today is Jeremy R. Hammond. He has a couple of websites. JeremyRHammond.com and foreignpolicyjournal.com. He is the author of several books, including Obstacle to Peace, which I believe is his most recent book. He also wrote Ron Paul versus Paul Krugman, Austrian versus Keynesian Economics in Financial Crisis, Benny Morris's Untenable Denial of the Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He also wrote The Rejection of Palestinian Self-Determination and Exposing a Zionist Hoax, How Ilan Jurnos, What Justice Demands, Deceives Readers About the Palestine Conflict. I guess that's your most recent one, actually.
Correct.
Yes, it was written, published in June 11th.
Correct. Although that one's only available as an ebook, whereas Obstacle to Peace, which was the one before that, in my biggest book, is available in print as well.
Right. Yes, I have it in the Kindle. And I also have a book that you offer as a download on both of your websites, which is, wonderful. And I hope that people will avail themselves of that book. And it's called The Israel-Palestine Conflict, a collection of essays, and I downloaded that some time ago, and I hope that our listeners will also download that that collection.
Sure. So, and if I just may interject, where they can find
sure.
it quickly. So if you go to my website, as you mentioned, JeremyRHammond.com, and right in the navigation, there's a link for free stuff, and if you go there, you'll see that download as well as other downloads that you can get to get on my mailing list.
Okay. People are always intrigued by free stuff. Alrighty. Your book, the one that I am currently reading, and I do intend to get a couple of other ones, is Obstacles to Peace, the U.S. Role in the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. And you make mention, and you've said that the government perpetually lies to the public. No. Do they really? About important issues. The mainstream media dutifully serve to manufacture consent for criminal policies. And what you do in your writing, and I definitely express my appreciation for your succinct writing ability, but you say that you free people's minds by exposing state propaganda intended to keep them in servitude to the politically and financially powerful. And you go on to say, my writings empower readers with the knowledge to see through the deceptions and fight for a better future for ourselves, our children, and future generations of humanity. You say, I'm an independent political analyst, journalist, publisher, and editor of Foreign Policy Journal, which is one of your websites, and that again is foreignpolicyjournal.com. And you are the author of several books, which I've mentioned, and you also are a coach who helps writers communicate their ideas more effectively to make a greater positive impact. I think I could use your advice on this because I tend to be really redundant. Why write 10 pages on something when you could write 100? And so I need to be more succinct in my writing, but we won't talk about what my needs are. Let's talk about what you have done and what you're doing. And you also, in another area, have researched the vaccine issue. And I hope that we have an opportunity to talk about that, particularly as it relates to things that are going on in New York. Because I think you mentioned that New York was something. Okay, so your book, Obstacles to Peace, has it been a pretty good seller?
I wouldn't say, I'm not on a New York Times best-selling list.
Oh, that's good.
No, 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 I said I'm not.
That you're not.
Oh, it's good that I'm not.
New York best-selling list, that means that you're conflicted. That means that somebody has decided that they want to promote your ideas, and that is definitely not the case. So I kind of, when people are on the New York Times bestseller list, I think, something's wrong with them. Something's wrong with their writing. They're working for the government, so yes, definitely you don't want to be on their list.
Yeah, and I particularly aim at the New York Times in that book in terms of, propaganda and misinforming the public. So it's not. That's one thing. And also, I feel that the book is making an impact and it's reaching the right people. I feel, a lot of the feedback I've got about it is, for example, Richard Falk, who wrote the foreword to the book.
Which is amazing. Just the foreword and, the introduction mm-hmm. are fabulous.
Gene Epstein wrote the introduction and, it's been praised by Noam Chomsky and others. Who are, very well known in this area as commentator, analysts and in this area. So, I feel that it's making an impact and reaching kind of the right audience.
Exactly. I had a listener and good friend ask me a question that I want to get out of the way right away. He asked, I watched a debate hosted a while ago by Amy Goodman between Alan Dershowitz and Norman Finkelstein regarding the Arab-Israeli conflict. If you're familiar with Dershowitz's point of view, what do you think of it? Finkelstein doesn't seem to question the story about 6 million Jews dying in the Holocaust. Do you personally question that story? And also, do you feel that the reason that that Finkelstein is not employable or is not employed is because of his views on things? That's a lot of questions, but.
Well, let's start with the last one. It's pretty well known that I think Finkelstein lost his tenure as a result of his book Well, he never gained his tenure because of the book that he wrote exposing as a hoax, Joan Peters' book, which was called, From Time Immemorial.
Right.
I think that's an obvious impact.
And you mentioned that book in your book.
I'm sorry?
That name, Peters, is mentioned in your book.
I may have, I don't recall that actually, but
yes.
I may have mentioned it, yeah. And as far as the question about the Holocaust, I mean, it's really totally irrelevant. I'm not a Holocaust denier. I mean, the Holocaust happened, whether it was 6 million or less than that or more than that. I mean, I don't know. I haven't researched that issue to know. I mean, I certainly may question the numbers, that it happened is not something I question. And it's not really relevant. I mean, I've seen the debate, so that's why I say it's not really relevant, because I am familiar with the debate. And of course, Finkelstein doesn't question that. That wasn't something that they debated.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't relevant to the point of the debate, which was more about the nature of the conflict, and what's really happening. To answer the question about what's my view of Dershowitz's views, he's a propagandist. I mean, I show that very clearly in one section of my book in which, he had written an article attacking, Richard Goldstone, who was that headed up the Goldstone Commission and the UN, that created the UN Goldstone Report, which
right.
made it familiar. Concluded that both Hamas and Israel committed war crimes during Israel's Operation Cast Lead, which was from December 27th, 2008 to January 18th, 2009, and called for that both, governing authorities to investigate themselves and their own actions and hold people responsible who were responsible for war crimes, and short of that, that the matter should be taken up by the International Criminal Court.
Right.
So, Dershowitz was writing a paper attacking this report, claiming that it was basically fraudulent and, poorly done and inaccurate. And I go through his paper and I actually show that every argument, every claim he's making about the Goldstone report, he's guilty of 10 times more.
Right.
He's just so dishonest. And I do a very detailed breakdown of that in my book. And that's basically, reflective of the nature of all of his work on this issue.
Right. I do appreciate your book, and you're right. The question about the Holocaust is certainly not relevant to what is going on now at all.
Well, it's relevant. I shouldn't say that entirely.
Well,
it's relevant in the sense that the Holocaust was used to justify what happened in Palestine and to justify the ethnic cleansing of most of the Arab population from their homes in Palestine. So it's relevant in that sense. I mean, it does have an impact on the history there.
Right.
But in terms of, the question of whether it happened or not, this is not,
it's not really
an issue. I'm sorry?
It's not something that you've discussed in your books.
No, yeah.
Okay. How did Hamas come to be? You've talked about that.
Yeah, I wrote about that in actually the first chapter of the book. And the point that I make is that Hamas was actually, tolerated, if not supported by Israel, during the time of its origins because, the Palestinian Authority had become a threat to Israel. Because it had accepted the two-state solution, it renounced Yasser Arafat renounced terrorism, went before the UN, accepted UN Resolution 242 as a basis for negotiations and as a basis for a resolution to the conflict, and accepted the two-state solution. And so this was a political threat to Israel because Israel, of course, has always rejected the two-state solution and rejects Palestinians' right to self-determination. And so to counter that threat, they tolerated, if not supported, Hamas, as a counterbalance, as a counterforce to the PA. to the PLO, I should say. The PA wasn't created at that time. and so, you know, the point is that, Israel wasn't so concerned about terrorism so much as it is about, you know, these political aims, and primarily the political aim to block the two-state solution and block implementation of that solution.
Isn't that amazing to me, that they would do this? That they would, and you actually talk about this situation, about the lines, about the boundaries and everything, beginning in 1917. You mentioned the date 1917, and several boundaries through the years. And then the most recent one, of course, is the 1967 boundaries, and they would like to go back to those, the boundaries that were then set. You also mentioned that no country should be allowed or is allowed to maintain land that they have won during warfare.
Correct. Yeah, that's actually stated right in the resolution I referred to, Resolution 242.
Right.
It was passed by the UN Security Council after the June 1967 war, and and emphasized that principle of international law, that the acquisition of territory by war is inadmissible. And you know, in that context, you know, called on Israel to withdraw its forces from the territories that it occupied during that war, which means the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the Syrian Golan Heights, and the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula.
Right. And they are the ones that actually started the war. And,
correct.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's one of the things, you know, the Arabs get blamed for that war. Although it is acknowledged, I mean, it's not controversial that Israel fired the first shot of that war on the morning of June 5th. It launched a surprise attack against Egypt and virtually wiped out its entire air force while it was still on the ground. So that's, you know, not controversial. But what is, you know, controversial, actually not even controversial, but the narrative that we're given, you know, universally, is that was a preemptive attack. That Israel was preempting an Egyptian invasion of Israel, and that is something that there's just no evidence for. In fact, Israel's own intelligence had assessed that, you know, that Nasser didn't want bloodshed, and there wasn't a threat of attack. The CIA did predict that there was going to be a war. Johnson was informed by the CIA that there was a war coming, but he was told that it was going to be started by Israel, and that's exactly what happened. The CIA was actually very accurate in its prediction. So that's a big, you know, point of, there's a lot of propaganda talking points that are accepted is though true, like this claim that was a preemptive strike. Well, it's at least highly debatable, if not, you know, outright false. I mean, that's being too generous. I take that back. It is false because by definition, it wasn't preemptive. I mean, it was no imminent. There is no evidence that there was an imminent invasion by Egypt. So that's an important point. But regardless of who started the war, the point remains that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. And you know, Zionists like to come back with the counterpoint that, well, you know, it was a war of defense. Well, even if we granted that it was a war of defense, it doesn't matter. The Security Council did not say, you know, except in cases of self-defense. Well, there's an obvious reason for that, which is that, well, every aggressor always claims self-defense.
Right.
So just claiming self-defense doesn't justify war and the acquisition of territory by war. And the principle is, you know, the acquisition of territory by war is inadmissible, period. So Israel is required by that resolution to withdraw. And there's, you know, you probably have heard this, you know, well, the article "the" what was missing from before the words, you know, territories occupied in the, you know, in the clause of the resolution calling on Israel to withdraw, and so therefore the Security Council didn't intend for Israel to fully withdraw, and Israel could keep some of the territory it occupied. Well, first of all, this is completely irreconcilable with the principle of international law emphasized, and second of all, I mean, just with regard to the article "the" before the phrase territories occupied. It has no impact on the meaning of the resolution with respect to the extent of withdrawal.
Right. Jeremy, we do have a quick 3-minute break, so let's pick this up on the other side of the break. Thanks. Sure. Be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Jeremy R. Hammond. He has two websites, jeremyrhammond.com and foreignpolicyjournal.com. He is the author of several books. The one that we're discussing is Obstacle to Peace, the U.S. Role in the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, which was published in 2016. He does have a more recent book, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that. But from my understanding, David Ben-Gurion, even in 1948, he was the executive head of the World Zionist Organization as early as 1946, and then became Israel's first prime minister, and he directed the government to develop a super-secret Israeli terrorist cell, Unit 131. And even as by the mid-1950s, when the United States was friends with Nasser and Egypt, Ben-Gurion actually envisioned an Egyptian terrorist attack against America in order to destroy that alliance. What is your feeling about that?
I've actually never come across that information in any of my research. I'm not familiar with this Unit 151.
Or 131.
131? Yeah, I'm not familiar with that.
So
I can't comment on that information.
It's just interesting that was, from what I understand, was the reason that they created this conflict, and it was during that war that the Israeli government sunk the USS Liberty on June 8th.
During the 1967 war, correct? Yeah.
Yes, which was awful, and of course it was covered up. But let's pick up where you left off right before we went to the break.
Sure. Yeah, and I just to anticipate, some objections to what I was just saying about how Israel was responsible for that starting that war, and also that it wasn't a preemptive attack. You know, a lot of the arguments that you'll hear are that evidence that Egypt was about to invade is the fact that it moved troops into the Sinai Peninsula. Well, but that's Egyptian soil, so Egypt has every right to do that, first of all. And second of all, the Soviet government, this is well known too, the Soviet government had passed on intelligence or information to the Egyptian government, warning of an Israeli attack in Syria, with whom the Egyptians were allied. And even though it seems that the Russians had greatly exaggerated the threat, the fact that there was a threat, it did exist. And also, Nasser had been, just criticized by Jordan for sitting behind this UN force while Israel attacked the village of Samu. And just killed civilians in this Jordanian village, before the 1967 war. So there were reasons to believe, from the Egyptians' perspective, that Israel was preparing for a major, military confrontation. And the CIA looked at the Egyptian troop movements and pointed out that they were in defensive positions. So there's that. And then, regarding that UN force. So after the Suez crisis, when Israel conspired with Britain and France to attack Egypt after Egypt nationalized the Suez Canal, what's the year? 1954, I believe. So Egypt had already been invaded once by Israel, and had every reason to believe it would do so again. And so after the Suez crisis, there was a UN peacekeeping force on the Egyptian side of the border, along the border with Israel. And Zionists like to point to the fact that Egypt expelled that UN peacekeeping force, and they say that, well, that's proof that, he was going to invade. But there was actually a proposal to remove that that force to the Israeli side of the border. And Israel also rejected that proposal. So if Israel was so worried about this, invasion from Egypt, why did that happen? So you hear these arguments, but there's really nothing to them. And the point remains that Israel's own intelligence assessed that Nasser was not going to attack. So just to kind of wrap up that point.
Right. But we never hear about those things.
No, they never.
We just hear about, what the New York Times states, particularly in their headlines. They can give you the spiel, in the article itself, mm-hmm. but a lot of people don't read the article. They look at the headlines and they get their entire a feeling for something, their entire viewpoint about something just by reading the headline.
Correct. And I give examples of that in the book. Yeah.
Right.
Where the headline says one thing, like saying that Hamas, Israel attacks Gaza after Hamas, rockets. And then you read the article and you find out, oh, well, actually it was Israel that attacked, Hamas.
Right.
First.
And killed children. And you also talk about the prison system in Israel, and they have children in the prison system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, illegally so, because it's actually a violation of international law for an occupying power to remove, the residents within an occupied territory to Israel. I mean, that's not legal for Israel to do that, but that's what it does. Just like building the settlements in occupied territories is a violation of international law, just like the wall that it's built in the West Bank is a violation of international law.
Exactly. Okay, we do have a quick break, and when you come back, let's talk about the wall that Trump is trying to build on the southern border. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Jeremy R. Hammond. His websites are jeremyrhammond.com. and foreignpolicyjournal.com. We're talking about his book, Obstacle to Peace, The U.S. Role in the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. And right before we went to the break, you mentioned the wall, and then I asked you your thoughts, if you could give us your thoughts about the wall on the U.S. southern border.
Well, my personal view of that is that there shouldn't be one. I don't agree with that. Although, I'm coming from a bit of a different perspective than probably many of your listeners, in that I oppose the institution of statehood altogether. I'm an anarchist. I don't believe in the state. And I believe that every individual has a right to travel and to, obviously not to trespass on private property, but in terms of just, being able to move around and live where you want to live and live a free life and do what you want to do. I fully believe in that right to self-determination. So that's the perspective that I approach that question from, in saying that I'm against the wall. At the same time, obviously, the refugee crises, immigration, mass immigration is a problem. I mean, it does affect it. It impacts the economy. There's negative consequences as well as positive consequences to that. It is an issue that needs to be dealt with. I just don't think that that's the solution to the problem.
I agree with you. I don't believe that there should be a wall. My feeling has always been, is it to keep people in or to keep people out?
Thank you for making that point. Actually, I wanted to say that before you went to break, that was the first thought that I have. So thank you for reminding me of that. Yeah, I mean, walls also keep people in. That was something that I wanted to say. So thank you for saying that.
Well, yeah. I see what the wall has done in Israel, and it has been devastating for the Palestinians,
mm-hmm.
and their right to work, their right to go where they should be able to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's abhorrent that this wall was built. If the U.S. wanted to do something about the immigration policy, which immigration started to be an issue back in 1965 with John McCain, who you've mentioned in your book, and Ted Kennedy of Chappaquiddick fame. And I believe that if a country wants to have immigration policies, that would be the way to effectively do this. And, of course, if they did not interfere in other countries and destroy the economic feasibility of other countries, the citizens wouldn't move. And if the U.S.
And the same thing applies to Europe. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Right. If the U.S. and their allies did not bomb the heck out of other countries, destroy their infrastructure, their culture, and their water supply, everything else, these people wouldn't be traveling.
Exactly.
People don't want to leave their country. They want to live and be free in their country and have their family alive. Yes, that's my feeling.
Yeah, I think you just nailed it. I totally agree. I mean, that's really the thing. You know, look at the refugee. I just wanted to interject. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just needed to interject that because it's such a good example of that in Europe and in the immigration crisis there with all these refugees from Syria and elsewhere throughout the Middle East. Which, you know, that crisis wouldn't exist if it wasn't for U.S. foreign policy. And you start, you know, starting with the U.S.'s illegal war of aggression against Iraq and then its, intervention in Syria and going from there. So yeah, I think you nailed it. And I totally agree with that.
Good. I know we agree on numerous issues, just from reading your book. I totally agree. You were talking, where do you want to go from here?
I was anticipating discussing the vaccine issue, but if you want to continue on the Israel-Palestine conflict, that's really up to you.
Okay. You talk about, or people say, oh, the policy towards Israel has changed with each administration, when in fact it hasn't changed a bit. For generations, correct?
You know, in marginal ways, you know, obviously there's marginal changes within the government, but I don't really follow the politics that closely because it's, I take kind of a broader approach and, you know, looking kind of more at the bigger picture,
mm-hmm.
In which case that's absolutely correct. I mean, it's kind of the same as foreign policy between Democratic and Republican administrations, you know, there are marginal differences, but, you know, Obama continued Bush's policies right across the board in pretty much every meaningful respect, including the policies toward the Israel-Palestine conflict. So, you know, there's always marginal differences between political parties within a government. But, you know, in a real, very real sense, they're really just two heads of the same beast.
Exactly.
And that beast just continues, you know, stomping its way through the course of history, you know, regardless of which head is, you know, happens to be in control at a given moment in time.
Right.
So I don't really even pay that much attention to the politics, except in as much as it impacts actual events. You know, like, for example, you know, Israel's military assaults on Gaza, things like that, things of that nature. So, yeah, to me, there's just a bigger picture to see.
Right. And of course, people have very poor memories, I believe. And even for short-term kinds of things.
Yeah.
Because the Democrats were pushing for a wall. They wanted a wall. But as soon as Trump, a Republican, wanted a wall, then all of a sudden they're against a wall. And people forget that they have just 24-hour memory. Memories, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
They forget from day to day. And you've talked about programming. That people are really programmed to believe, authority figures. And you said that the government perpetually lies to the public. And that is true.
Mm-hmm.
And, so anyway, if you'd like to, let's see, the humanitarian crises. It's in chapter 2. This just really makes me very upset that so many of the Palestinians are slaughtered. Just literally slaughtered. Children, particularly. If they throw a rock, then they might get, you know, shot in the head.
Mm-hmm.
How can a human being shoot a child in the head or an infant or it just I just can't fathom the inhumanity of such behavior. And that's what you talk about.
Yeah, are you referring to the section, the humanitarian crisis?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. In which the topic of that section of chapter two of my book, which chapter two is totally on Operation Cast Lead, which is the same operation I mentioned earlier.
Right.
With respect to the Goldstone Report. And the point of that chapter was just to show how Israel was denying that there was a humanitarian crisis ongoing in Gaza. And just how absurd that was. And you know, how, and the whole purpose of that military operation was to punish the civilian population, essentially for having Hamas as its governing authority.
Right.
And Israel, you know, you have, Ariel Sharon's, you know, head advisor of Weiss class saying in one of their internal meetings, it came on, you know, Haaretz, I believe, reported, that he, you know, his view was that after Hamas won elections and then they implemented this blockade policy of Gaza, you know, total siege, essentially blocking humanitarian, you know, goods from entering, blocking the movement of people and goods in and out. The purpose of that was to, he compared it to the Palestinians like having an appointment with a dietitian. They'll get a lot thinner, but they won't die. And that was essentially, and that was confirmed in U.S. that was the purpose of the policy of the blockade. It was confirmed in U.S. State Department cables that were published by WikiLeaks. And you have the embassy in Tel Aviv cabling Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State in Washington, saying, yeah, econ officers have confirmed with Israeli officials that their intent is to keep Gaza on the edge of humanitarian catastrophe without quite tipping it over. You know, so these denials of what Israel's policy and its purpose and its intent were just really preposterous, and just, you know, so that's kind of what that chapter is about, is kind of going through and just showing how preposterous those denials are. And the reality on the ground of you know, civilians, you know, like you hear all the time that, oh, Israel, you know, is the most moral army in the world. Such great care to protect civilians. It even dropped leaflets warning people, you know, to flee harm. Well, you know, there were investigations by organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, you know, the UN, the Goldstone Report. And they all looked at this, you know, this dropping of leaflets as an example. And they all criticized it because all it did was just create panic and made people rush out into the streets where they'd be even more likely to be killed.
Right.
Israel warned people to flee to the city center in Gaza City, and they did. And then Israel bombed the city center. Israel warned people to flee to shelters. They fled to UN shelters, UN run schools that are in Gaza. Israel bombed the schools. So, the idea that these leaflets were, you know, such a, you know, noble, you know, example of Israel, you know, taking such care to protect civilians is just total, you know, total propaganda, total nonsense.
Right.
I just go through all those arguments point by point and just demolish them.
You say in that chapter, Israel had begun raining white phosphorus down on Gaza, incendiary munitions intended to be used on the battlefield as a smokescreen or for illumination, but a war crime under international law if used against civilian persons or objects. And the World Health Organization reported that the Palestinian death toll had risen to 548, including 44 women and at least 120 children. Inasmuch as these organizations are aware of this, why does Israel continue to get support and military support as well as financial support from the U.S.?
The example of white phosphorus is actually a really example to illustrate the answer to that question. And the answer is because people just don't know what's actually happening. So, for example, Israel did use white phosphorus in Gaza illegally, in violation of international law, targeting civilian persons and objects with it. And the Israeli government initially, for quite some time, denied that it was even using white phosphorus. And the Western mainstream media was completely complicit in covering up the fact that Israel was using white phosphorus and to a ridiculous extent, such that you could go to the BBC or the CNN and read an article about the white phosphorus question, and they would just quote Israel, you know, it would say something like Palestinians have accused Israel of using white phosphorus, but Israel denies it. And that's the reporting. And they have a photograph accompanying the article online showing white phosphorus raining down in residential neighborhoods. You know?
Like, yes.
Like photographic proof that, you know, it wasn't just a Palestinian accusation. It wasn't just Palestinians making a claim that hadn't been confirmed. I mean, Human Rights Watch was on there. It was on the ground watching it. They're reporting that Israel was doing it. I mean, it wasn't like just but the way the media reported it as though it was just some unconfirmed Palestinian claim, when it was an absolute demonstrable fact, you know, with eyewitnesses like, you know, Human Rights Watch on the ground and photographic proof of what was happening. You know, it just, that level of deception and that level of complicity in what's happening. And of course, the white phosphorus munitions that Israel used were provided by the U.S. and U.S. government. So you have the mainstream media, you know, serving this function. And by the way, I should mention, you know, you talked about how I talk about, you know, how the media manufacture consent,
right,
for U.S. policies. And I should mention where I'm borrowing that term from. Of course, Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky, their book, Manufacturing Consent,
right,
The Political Economy of the Mass Media. And they in turn were borrowing it from Walter Lippmann. And so, you know, this is just such a good example of how the media do that, by completely misrepresenting the issue. You know, like treating that as an unproven allegation from the Palestinians, when in fact, you know, it was totally uncontroversial that Israel was doing that.
And they write it up to not only negate the claim, but to make the Palestinians look like a bunch of liars.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
And of course they also use phosphorus, on the USS Liberty. And, so I really am grateful for your book. Now, do you see, Trump doing any different, making any decisions that would accommodate Israeli objectives? Or do you see that he is saying, now wait a minute, we're not going to do this, we're going to pull all of our troops out? Or what do you see him doing, besides changing the I don't know how he can change the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. How does that happen?
Yeah, I think that I think the reason Trump made the decision is because he doesn't understand, the way Obama did, the necessity for the U.S. government to maintain the illusion of U.S. neutrality and the, you know, the illusion of the U.S. as a neutral mediator in a conflict. Because that illusion has to be sustained in order for the so-called peace process to continue. Obama was very, very clever in that respect, in understanding that and doing what he could to maintain that illusion. Whereas Trump, you know, he's just setting aside all illusions. He's basically just coming out and saying, well, I'm going to back Israel. And so I'm going to say that, you know, Israel is, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, even though, you know, under international law, East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. It's not disputed territory. The New York Times, Washington Post, they constantly talk about East Jerusalem as quote unquote disputed. It's not disputed.
Right.
I hear the music will come back.
Right. We'll be back in 3 minutes. All righty. Welcome back. We've got about 3.5 minutes or so before we get to the top of the hour. Our guest today is Jeremy R. Hammond. His websites are jeremyrhammond.com and foreignpolicyjournal.com. RBN.com. He is the author of several books, including the one that we've discussed today, Obstacle to Peace, the U.S. Role in the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, and about four other books. It is amazing to me that people aren't better prepared, better educated as far as this, but they, as you mentioned, they are programmed. They are lied to on a regular basis. But telling children, I don't know.
Maybe just to come back to the point about Trump and Jerusalem, I just also want to mention that the embassy move is actually illegal. It's a violation of a U.S. Security Council passed in, I believe it was 1980 or 81. I don't remember exactly which year. Which called on UN member states to remove their embassies from Jerusalem and not to establish embassies in Jerusalem precisely because it's so prejudicial to the rights of the Palestinians. Again, East Jerusalem being, unequivocally, it's occupied Palestinian territory under international law. It's not disputed. Whereas Israel claims all of Jerusalem as its undivided capital. So obviously that's highly prejudicial to the rights of the Palestinians. And that's
right.
For the UN's telling UN members not to establish, embassies within Jerusalem because of how prejudicial it is. Not only was Trump's embassy move, contrary to the policy of trying to maintain this illusion of neutrality, but also, it actually violated a UN resolution.
And when he did that, I thought, well, who the heck does he think he is?
Yeah.
That's another country. What's he? I don't know. I know it's just, and I was there. I was in Jerusalem in 99. Things have gotten far worse than they were when I was there. And when I was there, it was terrible. I've seen the Golan Heights and that was before, that was when it was still kind of peaceful. But I talked with some Palestinian people on a one-to-one basis. And I visited with people in Bethlehem who had stores and, they've lost their businesses, the Palestinians, I mean, have lost their businesses, their livelihood, and you can see the poverty, their poverty, and their desperation, even then. And the other thing, too, that was very striking is that I went with a church group, and we were told not even to think of proselyting, not to mention Christianity, not to mention anything whatsoever that might be construed as proselytizing.
Mm-hmm.
And here we've got all of these Christian groups in this country who think that Israel is wonderful. Okay, let's pick this up after the top of the hour break, and then we'll get to the vaccine issue. Be right back.
Listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Jeremy R. Hammond. His websites are jeremyrhammond.com and foreignpolicyjournal.com. He is the author of several books. They're listed on, you know, the A site, which I have a love-hate relationship with Amazon, which I think that I mirror a lot of other people's views on Amazon. But he does have several books, one of which we talked about earlier in the program, Obstacle to Peace, the U.S. Role in the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, and Ron Paul versus Paul Krugman, Austrian versus Keynesian Economics in the Financial Crisis, Benny Morris's Untenable Denial of the Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which is in fact happening, darn it, and a couple of other books. And we were talking about the Christian organizations in this country that see Israel as some sort of sign of the last days, or that they're supposed to do whatever they're doing, no matter how many people they slaughter. What the heck? What is wrong with these people?
That's a good question. That's actually a very important question. Let me quickly interject, though, before I answer it. If for people who don't want to shop at Amazon, you can get my books at obstacletopeace.com. Obviously, that's the website, the official website of my book, the one we just discussed. But all my books are available there. So if you want to cut out the middleman, and I also have, you know, exclusively signed copies are available from obstacletopeace.com. In terms of Christian Zionism, it's a huge, huge kind of elephant in the room, really. I personally feel that there's a lot of focus, a lot of, you know, Palestinian, peace activists, activists who support Palestinians' rights, I should say, who focus on the Israel lobby, organizations like AIPAC, and influencing Congress and the government. And I certainly would not argue that there isn't, such an influence. There is, it's huge. It's an impact. But I think the focus on that really distracts from the even bigger influence, which is Christian Zionism. And I just put it this way, it doesn't require AIPAC money for congresspersons to vote the way they do on votes related to the Israel-Palestine conflict when they are themselves ideologically Zionists. Christian Zionism is just it's woven into the fabric of the country. So it doesn't require this the way it's characterized is that, you have this external power, influencing the U.S. government, but it's not so much that as much as it is, the Christian Zionist, influence and culture within America itself, that is just so pervasive. Obviously, especially among very evangelical, Christians who believe that, the establishment of Israel in 1948 was a fulfillment of prophecy, that, there's a strong belief that, Christians must support Jews no matter what, because, they're God's chosen people. And, these kind of very, religious views that kind of just disregard the facts on the ground and what the real situation is. It's kind of like it doesn't matter. You asked the question earlier, how can people, tolerate or support murder of children and this violence and this aggression. It's almost like that doesn't matter to a lot of people. They have this belief that, Israel is a fulfillment of prophecy and the U.S. should stand by Israel, and that's that. And their understanding of the situation doesn't go beyond that. But there are also, obviously there are so many Christians who do recognize what's going on, who do support Palestinians' rights, who do oppose the violence, obviously Palestinian terrorism as well as Israeli violence, oppose the violence on both sides. Who recognize that what Israel is doing is wrong, it's illegal, it's criminal, it's sinful. So I think, again, the one of the big problems is, there's always going to be a certain number of people that the facts just won't matter, and you're just never going to reach them. But I believe more, and I believe this very strongly, in fact, I wouldn't have written Obstacle to Peace if I didn't believe this very strongly, that I believe that most people, if they actually understood what was really happening, wouldn't feel that way. They wouldn't feel like, well, the U.S. policy is appropriate. You know, the U.S. policy of supporting Israel's crimes against the Palestinians. They wouldn't feel that that's appropriate if they understood it in those terms.
If
they understood that that's exactly what's happening, that is, you know, the U.S. is supporting crimes. And so they just don't understand because, again, they're just inundated with a false narrative by the government and the media.
Well, it's one thing to be lied to by the government and the media. It's quite another thing for so-called religious people to lie to their parishioners. And after my return from Israel in 1999, I began to take a very serious look at the church that I belong to. And that was the beginning of my disbelief and the beginning of my leaving, formally leaving that church, because, and you don't have to make the trip to Israel to come to a conclusion that yes, your religious leaders do lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I was also raised Christian. My parents, I went to church growing up. I'm not religious now. I was raised Christian. So I was really kind of brought up in that environment, you know, like people who held that view that, you know, the U.S. should support Israel no matter what. And I just remember growing up hearing that a lot. And that's actually probably one of the reasons that, you know, I'm interested in this issue is, you know, that background of mine. And just always, you know, reading about Israel in the Bible and, you know, that whole aspect of it. Just to stress the point that I was making earlier, that influence, I think, is much more powerful and much stronger than, you know, the Israel lobby.
I do too.
Yeah. And
it's
not to discount that influence. It's just, I feel by over exaggerating that influence, it takes attention away. I mean, the issue of Christian Zionism virtually never gets any focus and attention. And I think that's a mistake because I think that is the more powerful influence.
Oh, absolutely. Because people do not expect that their religious leaders are nothing but a bunch of liars. Well, that they're lying to them. Because you just expect better of them.
Sure. Certain religious leaders just take up the Zionist propaganda and then that they proclaim that to their followers as though that was truth. So yeah, they're lying and yeah, I agree with that.
Right. So anyway, I'm not, what am I? I'm not a follower of a 501c3 corporation anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. How did you get involved? Did you want to go on to talk about the vaccine issue?
Certainly. How did I get involved in that? Well,
yes.
I'd always kind of paid a little bit of attention to that issue just out of curiosity. You know, I just in my childhood, I remember always wondering, like, it didn't make sense to me. Like, I was told that, you know, the way a vaccine works is they take like a part of the viral or bacterial antigen and, you know, they put it in the vaccine and then, you know, they weaken it so that it doesn't actually cause, you know, your symptoms and then they inject it into you and it does cause your immune to respond. Your immune system to respond and develop immunity without having to go through the symptoms. And I just always thought, like, well, then how is that different from just getting the natural disease and developing immunity to it? I always wondered that. I never, you know.
Right. When I was a child.
I had a child's understanding of how it worked, right? And so I always had that question. And I've always just been curious about the issue. And
sure, if you got
I never really researched it.
They had chicken pox parties.
Right.
You wanted to give your child, let's get this over with. You're going to get it. Let's go ahead and get it over with. It wasn't any big deal. Chicken pox is not lethal. Mumps aren't lethal. All of these so-called diseases that people are being vaccinated for are not lethal.
Well, let's be fair. They can be lethal.
I suppose.
But it's very rare. I mean, the mortality rate for these diseases, it's a rite of passage. For me, it was a rite of passage. Just
sure.
To get chicken pox. I mean, I had chicken pox. I didn't have measles because, you know, obviously the situation changed, but I was born in 77 and, you know, so measles wasn't really around and I was vaccinated. But the thing is that, you know, today we have this childhood schedule where by the time kids are 18 years old, they could have had 70 or more doses of, I think it's 19 different vaccines. And so we're talking about a whole different thing from like the vaccines that I got, you know, when I was a child. And so anyways, back to the question you were asking about how I kind of get into it. So around, well, in 2012, my son was born. And so, leading up to that time and, you know, my wife was pregnant and I began researching this issue for that reason. You know, we were about to become parents and I wanted to be able to make an informed choice. So I began very, very, you know, in a very focused and intent way, researching this issue and primarily by going into the medical literature and just investigating and seeing things for myself, you know, doing things like reading the package inserts that come with the vaccines, you know, that doctors are supposed to read those warnings to their patients and they don't, you know, starting with that and then going to, and there's a great resource I want to mention to your listeners, pubmed.gov, PubMed.gov, government run website run by the National Institutes of Health, where you can search the medical literature and just find out what the science actually has to say. And so that's the point I want to stress here is that what the government and media say that science says about vaccines and what science actually tells us about vaccines are two completely different and incompatible things. And that was my discovery. And the more I researched, the more I realized just how frightening that disparity is today. And it's not just an issue where our health is being threatened, but you know, our liberty is also under assault. And specifically our right to informed consent is under assault. And we see that in California is the best example of that.
Right, absolutely. There are certain laws that you cannot send your child to school without them being fully vaccinated. You cannot send them to daycare centers.
Right, and what they've done in California is to eliminate, for you know, anyone who doesn't know, to eliminate non-medical exemptions.
Right.
To vaccines to enter school. And this happened in the wake of the 2015 Disney measles outbreak, which we can talk about. But the point for now is that they passed that law to eliminate non-medical exemptions. But we need to understand what that means so that parents now can only get a medical exemption, which might sound reasonable until you recognize that. Like Richard Pan, who had, you know, he was the
terrible person. You should be ashamed of
him. He was the guy who basically headed up that fight to pass
right,
this
right.
law. If you listen to his view of the role of a doctor, he believes, he said this, he wrote an article in the medical literature and he said this, that the doctor, when writing an exemption, is exercising an administrative function for the state. In other words, government bureaucrats are deciding what should happen with their children, what vaccines they're going to get, when they're going to get them. And it isn't up to the doctor. And the doctor has very little leeway to be able to write an exemption, because they're very limited. You know, instead of the doctor and the parents who are the only, you know, parties who have the individualized knowledge necessary to be able to make a choice for an individual child, you know, instead bureaucrats, you know, in the state government or in Washington are, dictating, you know, what does and does not count as a medical exemption. And it's very, very, narrow definitions. You know, for example, like if you had a prior, you know, allergic reaction to a vaccine, okay, you can get an exemption. Like, so if you almost died from it, yeah, they won't make you do it again, but you know, it's like that. And what's not happening is there's not recognition of the fact that there are children who are, number one, not everyone is at the same risk of the disease, right? Number two, not everyone is at the same risk of a vaccine injury or being harmed by the vaccine. And public policy is a one-size-fits-all policy that really plays Russian roulette with our children. It doesn't recognize. I mean, the CDC does not take into consideration what we now understand as science has you know, advanced, that there are certain children who are genetically predisposed to be at higher risk of vaccine injury. And so this is a big thing that the mainstream media don't talk about this. You know, the New York Times had an editorial a week ago today, attacking, what the media derogatorily call anti-vaxxers, which pretty
right.
much anyone who dares question
a bad
vaccine
person.
Policy. Yeah, it's just you're ignorant. You don't know the science and, you're just making an irrational decision if you don't strictly follow the CDC's schedule exactly as the CDC, prescribes it, then you're an anti-vaxxer.
Well, the CDC admits on its website that out of the last 20 years that the flu vaccine has not been effective at all. And some of these, like the bird flu, that was a crisis that was developed in Mexico that wasn't even an actual disease. It was a government crisis that everybody was supposed to get these flu vaccines. And in fact, George H.W. Bush said when he was asked if he was going to get the flu vaccine, he said, heck no, I'm not going to get that vaccine.
I don't remember that. Well, there was actually a bird flu, but the risk from it, it was so hyped up. I mean, every time one of these new, influenza vaccine subtypes
or all this stuff.
Yeah, the swine flu, the bird flu.
Zika virus.
They always use it, to push public policy and to urge everyone to get out and get vaccinated. But there's actually a study done by a guy named Peter Doshi who looked at the question of, we're always being warned about these horrible flu pandemics. And he just looked at the pandemics, and with the exception of, it was 1918, I think, that there was a major flu pandemic that was quite deadly.
Oh, well, that was something, that also had to do with the war, because, there was, Schmedley Butler was a general in that war, and a lot of the people that died of the flu, it was actually because of the circumstances of the war and where they were located. And what he did with his men is that he cleaned up the area where they were located, gave them better rations, and treated them like they were actually officers instead of enlisted men. And they escaped the so-called death by flu. And so you have to look at the circumstances under which people are dying. I haven't read anything about it recently, but there are books written specifically about that flu. And of course, even if you look at the smallpox vaccine, that was when they used the smallpox vaccine in the Philippines, the Filipinos were a virgin civilization. They had never experienced smallpox at all until they got the vaccine. And then there was three epidemics that killed thousands and thousands of people.
Go ahead.
And what they did was the U.S. government had created a lot of vaccine, and they couldn't use it, and it was shelf worn, it was out of date, it was no good. So they just thought they would use it on the guinea pig Filipinos. Okay, we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Alrighty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Jeremy R. Hammond. His websites are jeremyrhammond.com, foreignpolicyjournal.com, and obstacletopeace.com. Buy your books there instead of at the A place. So I'm glad you told me that. I'm sorry I didn't realize that before. So the CDC admits things, but who's going to look at the CDC if their doc, their white-coated doctor tells them that, that they need to have a vaccine? It's, there's a commercial on TV, that shows an individual, in her kitchen, and she's talking, just talking, and then she goes into the room and she's got this white coat on, and all of a sudden she takes on this air of authority, and she looks more believable and seems to radiate authority, so that now you believe her when she says this vitamin is the best one for you, or whatever the heck she was promoting. But do you find that to be the case?
Well, I definitely find it to be the case that the CDC says one thing in its public relations messaging and admits other things,
right.
You know, in terms of, like, for example, CDC researchers and what they're publishing in the medical literature, things like that. And I'll give you an example of that, but I'll kind of segue into that, actually. If I'll just might jump back
sure.
a moment to what I was saying about the researcher Peter Doshi and the pandemics. So he actually looked at that question, and he showed that actually with that one exception of 1918, the flu pandemics that have occurred have actually been less severe than the just the usual influenza, you know, the usual seasonal flu. And there are actually studies showing that, in fact, annual flu, getting an annual flu shot can actually increase your risk of illness. Not only your risk of the flu, but also risk of other illnesses. And I'll give you a couple of examples. So, there was a study in Canada that looked at, looked at a series of studies, that were done in Canada, finding that, a receipt of the, what was it? I think it was the H1N1 flu vaccine in 2009, was associated actually with an increased risk. And then other studies have looked at that. And there's a reason for this. And there's the biological mechanism for that is actually, elucidated in the medical literature. And it has to do with what I like to call the opportunity costs of vaccines, which is that, when you get vaccinated, you're developing, a kind of a vaccine conferred immunity. But it's not, contrary to what the CDC says, it's not the same as natural immunity. And it's not nearly as good. I mean, let's face it, natural immunity is just superior. And so what the vaccine is designed to do is to stimulate an antibody response. This is the immunity that you gain from the vaccine. But what people don't really understand is that that's not the only part of the immune system. That's not the only kind of immunity. And there's also another branch of the immune system called, which is called cell-mediated immunity. And while the vaccine kind of skews the immune system to have this kind of antibody response, by vaccinating, you're denying the opportunity to be naturally infected with that influenza virus and develop natural immunity, which would include not only a strong antibody response, but also a strong, robust cell-mediated immunity that would protect you against not only that infecting strain, but also other strains of influenza, which is a benefit the vaccine does not confer, and even other viruses altogether. There's one study that was done. It was a randomized controlled study, which is a bit of an unusual because usually they do retrospective observational studies. This one was a randomized controlled study that found no evidence that the influenza vaccine was actually effective. It didn't prevent the outcome, even though it did stimulate an antibody response, and they equate that with immunity. I mean, that's how the FDA passes vaccines, vaccines gain licensure. If they can demonstrate an antibody response, they equate that with immunity. That's not the case. That's scientifically invalid, because again, an antibody response is not the only kind of immunity. And so vaccines tend to skew the immune system toward this Th2, antibody humoral immunity at the expense of lost cell mediated immunity, which, provides much more protection. And this is the explanation for why, people who got vaccinated that were actually at higher risk of that 2009 influenza virus that was circulating that year. And coming back to segue into that point about the CDC and, how its public messages are completely different from, what the science says. And a great example of that is the CDC's recommendation that all pregnant women get a flu shot during any trimester. Well, if you go into the FDA's website, just Google FDA vaccine package inserts. Just Google that. Right. And the page will come up, and you can go and look at the vaccine package inserts, which are legally required. The manufacturers are legally required to have those in the vaccine packages. And you can go right in there and look at the vaccine package inserts where it says, manufacturers say, studies to determine the safety for pregnant women have not been done.
Right. What's a little mercury, right?
But here's the CDC telling women it's safe. Don't worry about it. And I'll continue on that point when we come back.
Okay, we'll be right back. All right, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Jeremy R. Hammond. His websites are jeremyrhammond.com, foreignpolicyjournal.com, and obstacletopeace.com. And but we're talking about vaccines, which he is also very educated on, and is offering us some additional information that we need to know. Absolutely.
Yes, yeah, so if I might come back to that point about the CDC and this, yes. The disparity yes, between sir. Its public messaging and you know what the science is telling us. Again, you know, the CDC. As I was discussing before the break, there. The CDC recommends pregnant women get an annual flu shot, even though the manufacturer's own package inserts state right in there that the studies to determine the safety of doing that haven't been done and warns against that practice. And yet the other thing that's just really astonishing about the CDC's recommendation is it doesn't specify, it doesn't tell pregnant women that if they're going to get a flu shot, to get the mercury-free version. I'm sorry, is there a
I was coughing.
Connection issue?
Yeah, I'm muted.
Oh. Okay, may I continue?
Yeah, please.
Okay, sorry. So the CDC does not recommend pregnant women to get the version of the vaccine that doesn't have mercury in it, which is just really reckless and irresponsible because there's no reason, you know, if a woman is to get the flu shot, there's no reason to expose the fetus to the potential neurotoxicity of mercury. It's completely unnecessary. There's no reason for the CDC to recommend that vaccine to pregnant women when they could just say, specify, get the one without mercury. So, and for people that don't know what I'm talking about, so there's two versions of the vaccine. One is a single dose vial of the vaccine, which is just obviously for a single dose given to individuals, and then there's a multi-dose vials, which, you know, if you go to Walmart or some of these places like this, they're more likely to be using the multi-dose vials. And because they're, you know, there's multiple doses being taken out of that vial, it has to have a preservative in it. By law, the FDA requires the manufacturers to use a preservative, and the preservative that they use is called thimerosal, which is about 50% ethyl mercury by weight. So ethyl mercury is a form of mercury, and it's neurotoxic. It's a known neurotoxin. And to expose, you know, a developing fetus to a known neurotoxin unnecessarily is really just, in my mind, is criminally irresponsible. But, you know, that's the CDC's recommendation. And the CDC does say, I mean, if you dig deep enough on their website, you know, in their pages talking about how pregnant women should get a flu shot, and one of them, they does say, well, you know, there is one. It does inform that there is a mercury-free version available, but it's very clear in saying that it doesn't recommend one over the other. Well, why not? Why would the CDC not recommend the one that doesn't have mercury in it over the one that does? I mean, that makes no sense. But the explanation for why that is because the CDC has really staked itself on the position that the mercury is harmless. And the reason for that is because in the late 90s, it was discovered that as the CDC was adding more and more vaccines to the, you know, routine childhood vaccine schedule, nobody in the government was actually doing the calculations to determine what the exposure levels would be, the cumulative exposure levels of children from the mercury. And when the FDA finally did get around to doing those calculations, I believe that was in 1998, if I'm not mistaken, when they finally did get around to those calculations, they determined that the cumulative levels of mercury children were being exposed to was more, was greater than the government's own safety guidelines. And so that was a big scandal, which, you know, leads into the whole autism question. But the point is that after that, thimerosal was removed because of that. The decision was made to remove thimerosal from most childhood vaccines, but it is still contained in multi-dose influenza vaccine. So don't let anyone tell you, listeners might have heard this, that, you know, well, they remove mercury from all the vaccines. That's not true. It's still in the flu shots, which are given to pregnant women and infants as young as 6 months. Or the CDC recommends the influenza vaccine for infants as young as 6 months.
Is that sick or what?
It is sick, especially what science says about the safety of doing that. I've been focusing on the flu shot very intently with my writing in the past year. I'm actually doing a series right now, multi-part expose on the influenza vaccine. And the first part of that series starts out just looking at a New York Times article, and the New York Times article talking about the flu shot and how effective and safe it is. And they cite a 2010 study to support the claim that the influenza vaccine confers a great public health benefit. And, you know, interestingly enough, conveniently, they provide a link to that study in that article. And anyone who wants to click that link and read that study, can find out what that study actually had to say. It was a study by the prestigious international organization known as the Cochrane Collaboration, which is an independent scientific organization that specializes in a type of study called a meta-analysis, in which they just basically, do a search of the medical literature and like all the available studies that are out there, and they kind of compile them together and they look at the whole body of evidence and make determinations about what the evidence is telling us. And they actually concluded that the CDC's fundamental assumptions underlying its flu shot recommendation are unsupported by scientific evidence. And they went so far in their criticism of the CDC as to accuse the CDC of deliberately misrepresenting the science to support its policy. And this is the study that the New York Times is citing to support its claim that science shows us that the vaccine confers a great public health benefit. That's the level of deception I'm talking about when I say that what the mainstream media is doing is manufacturing consent for public vaccine policy.
Well, I think all the ABC agencies work for corporate America, and it's really just about money, because if you listen to hear me talk, you think I watch TV all day. But to listen to a Walgreens commercial, and they tell you how many flu vaccines they themselves, that company themselves, have given out, not given, have injected into people, it's something like 60 million times what? Somebody's paying for that. Whether it's somebody's insurance or whatever. And when you're talking about freedom, when you talk about the fact in California that children have to have these vaccines, you're talking about parents having to pay money to get something that they don't want to have that might be dangerous, but somebody's going to make some money on it, so it's okay. And then, The Federal Health and Human Services Commission, Health and Human Services is connected to each of the state's health and human services, and the federal government is one of the biggest consumers, of vaccines, and
yes, that's true. Yeah.
So you really have to question the whole operation.
It's not only that parents are being forced to consume a product that they don't necessarily want, but they're also paying to finance, let me put it this way, to pay for vaccine injuries. Because a lot of, another thing the mainstream media never talk about, they never address the real issues, and they have this caricature of what an anti-vaxxer is, that is just completely, devoid of, it's not reality. But, you know, so people are being told by the mainstream media the fact that the government has actually granted legal immunity to vaccine manufacturers. And not only that, but there's a program called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, VICP, which is effectively shifts the financial burden for vaccine injuries away from the manufacturers and onto the taxpaying consumers, because it's funded by an excise tax on each dose of vaccine given. So that is the taxpaying consumers who are financing, you know, this compensation program for vaccine injuries, while the manufacturers are not even legally liable for those injuries. So it's, I mean, what you described is correct, but it's much worse than that.
Right. I want to circle back to, I mentioned, and you mentioned it, about the influenza during World War I. And in one of my books, I state, toward the end of the war, technicians gathered up all the vaccines on the lab shelves and vaccinated every single U.S. soldier. The first time in history that a government has mandated compulsory inoculations in the military. This poisonous medical assault, the Stick diphtheria vaccine, outlawed years before in Austria due to the deaths of several children, killed more American soldiers than the war.
What is that taken from?
One of my books.
Is that the Smedley Butler book?
No, it's taken from, excuse me, it's taken from Screening Sandy Hook Causes and Consequences, which is mainly about health issues. It's people misconstrue what it's about because they're ignorant, if I can say that word. But I talk a lot about health issues and mm-hmm. It was the vaccines that caused the deaths.
That reminds me of, you know, the anthrax vaccine and during the first Gulf War.
Right.
You know, the soldiers were forcibly, you know, they didn't have a choice. They had to have that vaccine. And that has been associated, you know, and it's in the medical literature that, that is associated with Gulf War syndrome, you know, and among other things. I mean, there's numerous possibilities, you know, factors and variables in that. In terms of causality, you know, including depleted uranium munitions and, you know, chemical exposures. But the vaccine was one of them. And, you know, so that has been highlighted as one of the potential causal factors of Gulf War syndrome.
Right.
Yeah. So this idea of mandatory vaccinations, this is a really serious threat.
It is.
And people are just not awakened to the seriousness of this threat and the assault that's taking place on our rights right now, and our right to informed consent. And so that's really why I've shifted my focus away from other things that, you know, I'm obviously passionate about the Israel-Palestine conflict, but I've really, in the last year, I've really focused almost all of my writing on the vaccine issue. Precisely because of this, you know, it's one thing for me to, you know, to have a concern about, you know, people living in other countries and things, but, you know, I'm a father. And
right.
I live here and I kind of need to be focused on right now on this threat until at least to this, you know, maybe until I feel comfortable about it, because really it's scary to me what's happening. You see what's happening in California and, you know, maybe we should bring that up. You know, the pretext for that was that 2015, you know, measles outbreak.
Right.
Which, of course, we're all told, you know, the media just constantly, every time they talk about measles, they bring up the 2015 outbreak and how, you know, it's the fault of unvaccinated, you know, parents who are choosing not to vaccinate their kids. Interestingly, I went to the California Health Department's, you know, website at the time and looked up their data. And the majority, I think it was 64%, were adults. Most of the cases were in adults, not children. They weren't unvaccinated kids primarily who were getting measles. It was adults. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we're talking about a generation of people who, you know, were born they were vaccinated before the whole 1998, you know, Andrew Wakefield thing that we're told was the,
right,
that was the start of the whole anti-vaxxer movement. And you know, we're talking about people who were born in an era when, you know, the vaccination rates were very, very high, up in the top 90th percentile. You know, these are people who are predominantly were vaccinated, and they're getting measles. Again, adults, 64% were adults in California, not unvaccinated kids.
Right.
So what does that indicate? And that's what that's the elephant in the room that they don't want to talk about. You know, that they don't want to talk about the fact, it's totally uncontroversial in the medical literature, that the, you know, vaccine immunity wanes over time. They don't want to talk about that, that it fails, that it's not as robust as natural immunity, which is considered lifelong. And another problem isn't just that it's not as, you know, you don't get as robust immunity and as long-lasting immunity with a vaccine as you do from natural infection, but also, you know, the fact that measles, the vaccine has interrupted transmission of the virus. That is true. It does work. I mean, it is effective in that sense, but is that necessarily a good thing? Because then what happens is that people no longer in their adulthood, they're not getting that routine re-exposure, that routine natural boosting of immunity, so that later in life, they're protected all through their entire adulthood, through their elderly years. They're protected. Because the virus is circulating. That's exactly what creates herd immunity.
Right.
And so we've lost this natural herd immunity because of mass vaccination. And another example of that, you know, there's opportunity costs of vaccination that have to be considered that public health officials don't consider. Like, when there's population level effects, like the fact that today women, mothers aren't as able to confer immunity to their infants through the breast milk, because, you know, immune mothers pass antibodies through the breast milk to their infants, which protects infants. I mean, in the pre-vaccine era, that's what protected infants from measles. You know, so, you know, up to, you know, 6 months and under, especially, really, you know, require that immunity, because their own immune systems aren't developed yet. Their systems are still developing. And so they require that maternal immunity, that maternal protection. Mass vaccination has destroyed that, because now, you know, women who have been vaccinated and are losing their immunity, and they don't have that strong, robust, you know, herd immunity that we could have created in this country, had it not been for the, you know, measles vaccine coming around. And so they're not as able. And so now infants are, in the event of an outbreak, infants are actually at greater risk today than they were in the pre-vaccine era, precisely for that reason. Because mothers aren't as able to protect them with maternal antibodies.
Right. And they also, there's more C-sections, and so they don't, they also, by going through the birth canal naturally, it has beneficial, it's like trying to help a butterfly out. The butterfly needs to struggle and gain strength by getting out of the cocoon itself. And it's the same way with women giving birth. The infant needs to be born naturally, or should be born naturally, because it's just more beneficial. We will be right back in 3 minutes. All righty, welcome back. Our guest is Jeremy R. Hammond. His websites are jeremyrhammond.com, foreignpolicyjournal.com, and obstacletopeace.com. And you need to have one on your vaccine information, a regular website, right?
I currently just host all of my stuff right on jeremyrhammond.com.
But okay.
If you go to the navigation menu, I kind of categorize my blogs either by, you know, foreign.
Okay.
There's three categories, basically foreign policy, health and vaccines, and then liberty.
Okay.
And economics.
Okay. Speaking of economics, you mentioned previously about how many vaccines are given, usually in one shot. And if you didn't mention it, then it's a good time to mention it. The patient or the patient's parents pay 75 cents per vaccine to go towards a fund that if their child suffers that they can use that money, that the money is used to pay damages through the vaccine court, what is referred to as the vaccine court. And you have to have all this evidence when you approach a court. But the vaccine manufacturers are never held accountable either financially or in any other way for the damage that their vaccines are doing. It's
correct.
The people themselves.
Yeah, and another point, I'm glad you came back to that, because, you know, another point I should have made is that you know, how that removes, it eliminates the incentive for vaccine manufacturers to, you know, invest in developing more effective ways of combating communicable diseases. So you've eliminated that market incentive, you know, the fact that if they were liable for vaccine injuries, they'd want to try to improve their products. And so the Congress has just eliminated that incentive. And yeah, 75 cents, just to clarify, not 75 cents per vaccine necessarily, but per vaccine dose. So there are, some of the vaccines are combination vaccines. So MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella. So that's three vaccine doses.
Mm-hmm.
The other combination vaccine is the DTaP, DTaP. Which is mm-hmm. a diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis vaccine. So that's, you know, so yeah, $2.25 per dose there.
Right.
And that's how that's funded. So correct. Yeah. But then, you know, you were talking about the butterfly coming out before the break. And it just kind of struck me of how that kind of is a nice illustration of what I mean in terms of, the opportunity costs of vaccines and how, you know, like going through a childhood infection can really, you know, be a good thing. It can be a benefit because your immune system, that's how your immune system learns to function. It's training, literally training the immune system in what to do. And so there are some of the opportunity costs of vaccination include things like, you know, measles has been associated with a reduced risk of more serious diseases later in life. You know, such as, you know, including Parkinson's disease and cancer. And so the question arises, are we trading typically, at least in industrialized advanced countries with a high standard of living, measles is a benign disease. Yes, it can ravage countries where, you know, there's widespread malnutrition, you know, and vitamin A deficiency and things like that. But, in the U.S., for example, by the time the vaccine was introduced, you know, the mortality rate had already plummeted, so that only about 450 people a year died from measles. And so are we trading, you know, a benign childhood illness for much more serious diseases later in life? This is a serious question that hasn't really been scientifically investigated to the extent that it needs to be for us to be confident, you know, about what vaccines are doing.
Right.
Chickenpox is another great, great example.
Jeremy, could you stay over for a bit into the third hour?
Sure. Yeah, I can give you a little more time.
Okay, thank you. We'll be right back. Guest today is Jeremy R. Hammond. His website is jeremyrhammond.com, foreignpolicyjournal.com, and obstacletopeace.com. And we're talking about vaccines. And you mentioned Parkinson's disease, and you also mentioned cancer. Now, the polio vaccine was contaminated with the deadly carcinogenic SV40 virus, which is found in the kidney cells of the rhesus monkey, the cells that they used to grow the polio virus. And so we were told in mid-20th century that polio was this huge, major health crisis, and it was taking the lives of so many people in America. And yet, over 90 million people worldwide were vaccinated with the IPV virus by 1961. 2 years later, the scientists discovered that it contained SV40, which could infect and cause cancer in human cells. So I remember all the scare and how many people went out and got these shots. And other countries have also experienced this situation where they received the polio vaccine and they got polio or something even worse.
Yeah, no, that's actually true of both the polio vaccines, both the inactivated polio vaccine and the oral polio vaccine, which is the oral polio vaccine is a live virus vaccine, which can actually cause, like you mentioned, can actually cause polio.
Right.
Yeah, they were found to be contaminated with the simian virus 40, which is, you know, the SV40 virus right. you're referring to. And later studies have found that virus to be associated with, you know, with cancer. And so that's a great example of what I was talking about in terms of not just the opportunity cost of losing, losing those benefits of gaining that kind of immunity from early childhood infections, but then, you know, the risk of contamination in these vaccines, you know, the risk of, well, there's risk from the ingredients in vaccines that are intended to be in there, like the mercury and the aluminum. And then there's the risk from things that aren't intended to be in there, like, and a more recent, you know, more recent history, example of that from more recent history was the rotavirus vaccine, which I can't remember the years that came out, but it was the late 90s, I believe. And that was added to the CDC's schedule. And that was found to be contaminated with pig virus. In fact, both of the first two products that came out, the rotavirus vaccines, I think Merck had one, and then the other one was GlaxoSmithKline, I believe, had you know, a rotavirus vaccine on the market. And they were both found to be contaminated. I might have those two companies wrong. I forget the first two, which companies they were, but the two companies that had the rotavirus vaccine on the market first, they were both contaminated with, pig virus.
Yikes.
Yeah. And, when the first one was found to be contaminated, the FDA actually halted it. You know, they said, okay, well, we're going to stop this. We're going to stop this vaccine campaign. And then the second one was found to be contaminated. What did the FDA do? Did they say, okay, well, we're going to stop this one too. We need to do studies to determine what the threat, you know, let's do a threat assessment here. Let's do some safety studies. Like, let's determine what the risk is. And, you know, obviously let's get the contamination out of the vaccines. But no, they were just like, well, we're going to go ahead and recommend either vaccine again. And it's just continue, proceed. And, you know, with just some comment about how, well, you know, there's no evidence that this is, you know, associated with any harms in humans, so don't worry about it. We're just going to continue.
Wow.
That's what the decision was. So, you know, but that's the same thing, of course. That's the same thing they said at the time it was discovered that SV40 was in the vaccines. What did the public health officials say then? Oh, don't worry about it. There's no evidence that it, you know, that it's harmful. You know, only 20 years later, studies start coming out, or 30 or 40 years later, studies start coming out about how actually, yeah, that virus is associated with an increased risk of cancer.
Right.
So it's the same thing.
And Dr. Maurice Hilleman admitted that Merck's vaccines were contaminated, and he knew that they were producing cancer in the field trials in Russia that involved millions of people. And in America, following mass vaccination, the incidence of polio increased by 50% between 1957 and 1958, and by 80% from 1958 to 1959.
Yeah, the numbers with respect to polio are quite hard to interpret because one of the things that happened was after the introduction, you know, of course, we're always showing graphs of the, you know, the incidence of polio, and then mm-hmm. the vaccine came into the picture, and then there's this, you know, it plummets down, and we've all seen graphs like that. First of all, I want to make the point that this is uncontroversial. This is, I think, from a pediatric study, which is the Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and they say right in there, you know, 90% of the decline in communicable diseases, you know, in the 20th century occurred in the first half of the century before vaccines were introduced.
Right.
So the vaccines don't explain that, and what does explain it is an increasing standard of living, better nutrition, you know, better sanitation, refrigeration, you know, all these things, and so that's the first point. And then the other issue with the data in terms of the polio is that they changed the diagnostic criteria for diagnosing polio around the same time, so that, you know, what formerly would have been called polio was now being called something else.
Right.
And so that just as a statistical artifact accounts for, you know, a considerable amount of the decline that we're told was due to vaccines. And, you know, of course, you look at how polio was spread. Well, polio was spread through a fecal-oral route, meaning that, you know,
right.
like
yeah.
people were literally eating.
Right.
I won't
yeah.
swear, but, you know.
yeah. We know. It's a four-letter word.
Eating poop.
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously sanitation has a lot to do with that, you know, things like, you know, sewer systems and, you know, modern sewer systems and washing hands, things like this,
right.
you know, that's how you stop polio epidemics.
Right.
So, you know, we don't need a vaccine for it. It's just a matter of just knowledge of what the virus is, how it works, how it spreads and use a little common sense.
Right.
You know, it's the same thing with measles. I mean, vitamin A deficiency is a known risk factor for measles. So how come we, you know, how come we spend all these billions of dollars every year on all these mass vaccination campaigns? You know, what if we just spend all that money on, you know, educating people about good, proper nutrition and making sure people get plenty of vitamin A with the influenza vaccine? You know, instead of all these billions of dollars being funneled toward mass vaccination campaigns, what, you know, why doesn't the CDC tell people to make sure that they're getting sufficient vitamin D?
Because that wouldn't make any money for the corporations. And they
yeah.
represent the corporations.
They represent the corporations. Yeah, I mean, people have this perception of the government, you know, and the agencies like the FDA and CDC as though they're these regulatory agencies, you know, regulating and protecting us from these big bad corporations. But the reality is that the government is the vaccine industry.
Right.
The reality is that there is no, you know, what we need is a free market, you know, in health. And the problem is that we have this massive government intervention and it skews the science. I mean, when you have the government colluding with the industry to promote vaccines, you know, and to fund the science that's being done, well, guess what's going to happen with the science?
Right.
That's going to be skewed. And there are studies that talk about, I mean, there are studies that study the impact of public policy and the industry money on the direction of science and just how widespread scientific fraud is in the medical literature and how bad, you know, most science is, and how, you know, scientific consensus, we hear this word consensus all the time and, you know, is frequently wrong.
Right.
Know, there are studies that talk about this.
Just because somebody believes something is widely believed doesn't mean it's true.
Exactly.
It just means a lot of people accept things on faith alone without ever doing any study. And vaccines destroy the immune system that allows disease to develop. And they do just the opposite of what their manufacturers claim. Now, in 1977, Dr. Jonas Salk admitted to a Senate committee that mass polio vaccinations caused most of the polio cases throughout the country since 1961.
Yeah, no, the CDC admits that right on its website. I don't know about 61, but CDC admits since 79, every single case in the U.S., polio was caused by the vaccine.
Right.
So this is not controversial. Yeah, no, that's the case. And in countries now, what we're seeing, like for example, India, Pakistan, these third
right.
world countries that still have, you know, still using the oral polio vaccine, they're seeing more cases of polio caused by the vaccine than by the wild virus now.
Right.
And this is precisely why they stopped using it in the U.S. because the risk from the vaccine was greater by their own admission, than the risk from the virus. So, yeah, that's entirely uncontroversial. And that's why they switched to the inactivated polio vaccine. Which, you know, of course, instead of using the live virus, they put it through this process that effectively kills it. But while still allowing, you know, when they do inject it, it does stimulate an immune response, but it's not the same as natural infection.
Right.
And, you know, that's another point. I mean, we're told about polio and how horrible it was, and we see the pictures of kids in the iron lungs and things. But the reality is, again, this is just from the CDC's own pink book, 98% or 95, I don't remember the exact figure, but upper 90 percentile of cases were asymptomatic. I mean, most people who had polio didn't even know they had it.
Right.
It didn't cause any problems. It didn't cause any symptoms. They didn't even know. They developed immunity to it naturally, and that was that. And that was it. That's most cases of polio.
Right.
And they talk about reported cases, and you got to understand reported cases is something different from, you know, actual cases. Like with measles, like, you know, you always hear the media saying, you know, measles kills 1 in 1,000 children. Well, no, that's false. That's a lie. The number was, you know, 1 in 1,000 reported cases. But reported cases is just a fraction of the number of kids who actually got measles, and we know that too. I mean, we know that practically almost everybody was, you know, exposed to measles at one point or another in their childhood growing up. I mean, it was,
right.
I mean, again, 98 percentile of people, you know, were exposed to that. So the number of reported cases is completely different from the actual number of, you know, the actual incidence of the disease. So when they say 1 in 1,000, well, no, it was 1 in 1,000 reported cases. You know, so if you kind of do the math on that, and what that comes out to be is like, well, that's like 1 in 10,000. Like 1 in 10,000 people who were infected with measles died from it. Not 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000.
Which is
and that's
amazing.
What we're supposed to be terrified of.
And it could have been due to complications from something else.
Right, sure, yeah. And again, in the mortality rate was highest among people, you know, with, for, you know, like, for example, vitamin A deficiencies. I mean, it's no, the risk factors are known. We understand that, what the risk factors are. So, you know, if we just put the research and the financial resource, if we just allow the free market to sort it out instead of having the government in here telling people they can't sue the vaccine industry, you know, they have to get vaccines or they can't put their kids can't get a public education, you know, just let people decide, let the consumers decide whether they want to use them or not. Let the industry be liable for vaccine injuries so that they will have an incentive to develop, you know, more effective means of preventing disease. And then maybe some of that money could be, you know, we have this huge opportunity cost that everything's being directed towards vaccines. Maybe some of that money will be put toward things like, you know, let's figure out how, you know, how do we educate the public to eat better? You know, with these people's busy schedules and they don't have time to go to the gym and stuff, like how can we get people, you know, healthy and get the amount of exercise they need? You know, like there's research into, you know, more efficient exercises. I mean, how can you do an exercise for just 3 minutes a day and still, you know, get the amount of exercise you need to help build that immunity and build your strength? And, you know, how come there isn't this kind of research happening? You know, why aren't we focusing research in, again, why doesn't the CDC just advise people to make sure that they're sufficient in vitamin D? The CDC does list other things to do besides the vaccine to help prevent the flu. They talk about things like washing hands, covering your mouth, you know, when you cough. They talk about things that can help prevent the transmission. But they don't say anything. They don't say anything about other, like vitamin D, which is the big elephant in the room.
And they're not going to talk about those things on TV when they're promoting vaccines or other pharmaceutical drugs. And they show these wonderful pictures of people having fun. And then, and people, 75% of the population learn visually. In other words, what they see, they don't learn auditorially. They prefer visual. And so they see these wonderful scenes and all this, and they don't hear that, oh, this might cause death, it might cause heart attacks, it might do this, it might do that. And the United States is one of the few I think it's the only place, maybe New Zealand, although I think they may have changed their policies there, but the United States is the only country in the world that has direct-to-consumer marketing. And so you have all of these commercials on TV, and if you were to count the number of commercials that Big Pharma has on TV, just do like one channel during the entire day or whatever, you would find that we are inundated with propaganda for Big Pharma, and Big Pharma is still in bed with the corrupt members of Congress. And then you also have to figure in the idea of the Affordable Health Care Act and what that does to protect vaccine manufacturers. And what it actually does, people say, oh, gosh, we'll get to have access to medical care, and won't this be wonderful? When, in fact, if something becomes a law, like in California, if something becomes a law and you have insurance, and there's a standard of care, and the standard of care says, you will get this vaccine, or you will get this prescription, or you will do this or that, according to the standard of care, which was developed by the insurance companies, the hospitals, and big pharma, then if you don't, you're going to be in big trouble. So there are a lot of really good people who vote for a lot of really bad things because they think it's going to be a benefit when, in fact, they are giving access to their body to the government as a vehicle of profit. It's insane. Your thoughts on that?
Well, when you speak of standard of care, it just, I mean, I was, like I said, I'm a father. I have a 6-year-old son. We were expelled from the only pediatric dentist actually in our town. And there's numerous dentists, but there was only one pediatric dentist. We were going to her for a while and she kicked us out of her practice for not agreeing to follow standard of care because we declined fluoride treatment. And she kicked us out. She kicked us out. So, you know, that's an example of, you know, there's just the perverse influence of standard of care, you know, what they call standard of care.
Right. And they're all obligated to follow it or else they lose their license, which they get from the government.
Actually what she did is, in my view, a clear violation of Michigan Health Code. I live in Michigan. The Michigan Health Code is very clear that patients, have a right to care. You know, if somebody's in your practice, you can't just discriminate and deny them care, on a discriminatory basis. And part of that is the right to informed consent. And just because somebody doesn't do what a doctor recommends isn't a cause under the Michigan law to expel them from your practice. And so, I mean, there is actually, if you read the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, what she did is actually a clear violation. But I filed a complaint with the state about that. But of course they did nothing. So, the spirit of the law and the letter of the law are one thing. But, you know, the reality is that dentists are going to get away with that kind of thing. And the same thing with pediatricians. You know, with the vaccine issue, there's pediatricians that will kick you out of their practice.
Vaccines are their big moneymaker.
Yeah.
We do have a caller with a question. Joe in Oklahoma.
Yes, ma'am. Enjoy your program very much. Don't get to listen to it every week, but try to. On a related note to this, and I don't try to divert the discussion, but this these infections, along with the diseases that we get, our immunity is significantly reduced by the constant bombardment of all the antibiotics we receive, and they destroy the microbiome within the gut. And I really would like to make a little bit further comment. I hear that this
we'll hold you over, okay? We'll be right back. And we had a caller from Oklahoma. Joe, you had another comment that you wanted to make or a question to ask?
Yes, ma'am. But I think this ties directly to what you are talking about on the vaccines, one thing or another. But the immunity that our body has is compromised daily through not only the antibiotics that we receive for the, you know, we get a sniffle, so we have to take an antibiotic, or we have a bellyache, so we take another antibiotic, and the list goes on and on, to the cleaners that we use. And we kill off our ability to fend off diseases, and then you take what you're talking about with the vaccines, just adds to that. And you're talking about the stress of the natural birth. It's a documented fact that a natural birth will provide there's a link between a natural birth and Alzheimer's.
They do receive antibodies through the birth canal.
Correct. Yeah, that's correct.
And it's documented when these infants are swabbed with the vaginal fluids that you can help provide that immunity as going through the birth canal. And my wife is a retired medical researcher, and she continues to try to delve into what's going on and why people keep dying unnecessarily. But I thank you very much for your program and your efforts. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, I think Joe brings up a really good point. Just to clarify a point there, it's with the live birth, what it does is it inoculates the infant with not with antibodies, but with bacteria.
Right.
Because like you said, the gut microbiome, which is the bacteria that live in your gut. I'm so glad he brought that point up because it's so important. You know, this is one of the major discoveries of, you know, fairly recent science, you know, just the discovery of the microbiome and its effect, its impact and how important it is that we live in symbiosis with these bacteria, you know, with the whole vaccine paradigm, we're taught to be afraid, you know, like the answer to disease is like, there's these things called viruses and bacteria out there and they're bad and we need to protect ourselves from them and live in these bubbles where, you know, like we don't interact with these things.
Right. You know? And they're all throughout our bodies.
I know. We literally couldn't live without them. And you know, they play a role in our immunity. And that's why having that, that's where the immunity comes from, you know, with as far as live birth. That's different from mothers passing on antibodies to their infants, which is also another thing, but it just seeds the bacteria in the infant. And so that they didn't develop a healthy microbiome, to be able to perform these functions, you know, that we rely on bacteria in our gut to do things like, you know, to take amino acids and turn them into proteins. And, you know, there's certain things that you need. To be able to, for your immune system to function. And, there's studies out there about the connection between the gut and the brain and the gut brain axis and how the bacteria in your gut can affect your mood, and things like this. There's so much. It's a whole new frontier.
Right.
Science. I mean, we're told the science is settled. No, that's a whole new frontier right there.
Well,
We're just beginning to learn about how the immune system functions.
Right. And thanks for correcting on the difference between antibodies and bacteria. But the other thing is that the whole birth process has been medicalized. It used to be that children were born at home and they didn't need to go in for shots and for all the other medical paraphernalia, and the cost to have a baby now has skyrocketed tremendously.
Yeah, I think the other point that Joe made that I really want to emphasize as well, which again I thank him for making this point, is, you know, it's not just the vaccines, or it's not just, I mean, there's, like he said, there's so much. There's toxins in the air we breathe. It's in the furniture, and the spray they put on furniture to make it fire retardant. You know, it's in our food, you know, the GMO food, there's the glyphosate that they spray on the food, the pesticides,
right.
Herbicides, the chemical additives and, you know, preservatives and we are
antibiotics.
Yeah, antibiotics and now giving rise to superbugs with how, you know, that evolutionary pressure from overuse of antibiotics has led to, you know, bacteria becoming antibiotic resistant and much more deadly. And the same thing happens with vaccines, and the same thing theoretically can happen where, and in fact has happened. I mean, there's cases with the chicken vaccine is one case where they've shown that this has actually happened, where the use of the vaccine actually caused evolution of the virus to become even more deadly.
Right.
And you know, and we're really playing, you know, the scientists are playing God. And they don't understand what they're doing and the potential for negative consequences. You know, you look at the, like Joe was saying about, you know, the increase of diseases, you know, and sure. Yeah. We've seen a decline in diseases, you know, communicable diseases, you know, things, you know, measles and all that. But again, you look at the decline in mortality for most of those things, as well as incidence for a lot of those diseases. It had already plummeted well before the vaccines, and now we're seeing today, you know, all these kind of like autoimmune disease and neurodegenerative diseases.
Right, right.
Which is a whole new thing, and is one, you know, one has a relationship with the other.
Absolutely. Alrighty, we will be right back. Our guest is Jeremy R. Hammond, and we're talking about vaccines, and you can read about his views on that particular subject at jeremyrhammond.com. Just look up at the top at his various interests and choose vaccines and health and whatnot. We do have another caller, Dr. Kelly in California.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call, Deanna, and you always have stellar topics and guests, and thank you. I'm going to give you a little handful of rubies and diamonds here to go with your topic. One of my buddies authored a book called Vaccination is Not Immunization, and that was Tim O'Shea, so thank you for continuing the work here. And chiropractor Tim O'Shea. And I just wanted to add too that I read, I think in a Weston Price publication, that in China the women do not bathe for about a month prior to giving birth so that they can, you know, cultivate the various bacteria. And it's amazing how people travel all these miles to get the proper food to prepare your body for these things, and then, you know, you come out into this world, and then there's someone's face there, like Janet Napolitano, or Secretary Sebelius, you know, and you're horrified, like, don't touch my baby, right. You know, and so, and then adding to that, the consumption of high fat foods. Like, I just love the Weston Price, you know, queen for your pregnancy prep diet with the raw milk and the raw cheese. And those enzymes have been destroyed. And so let's support the 7 states that need to get lawful access to raw milk. Can you believe it? In this day and age. And the name for the, pasteurization test is the negative phosphatase test. And the people at Merck wrote the Merck Index 5 years before publishing the Manual of Diagnosis. The first line in the Merck Manual of Diagnosis says, man must learn to live in harmony with his environment. And then they... And then they spend the next several thousand pages completely screwing that up. And so, thanks for your work. And I really appreciate your work. And then there are publications, Judicial Watch exposed the Gardasil push, and Governor Criminal Brown did the 12-year-old authorization or consent as the new age to take the Gardasil vaccine, even for a young man.
Right.
And so, it's time to batten down the hatches and boost up your immune system. And thank you again for pointing us in the right direction.
Thank you, Dr. Kelly. Thank you for your call. All righty. Your comments on...
I think that's great what she pointed out about the Merck manual, beginning with, we must manless learn to live with this environment.
Right.
And then they do everything they can to mess that up and to, create chaos where we should live in harmony with our surroundings.
Well, that was before all the lobbyists.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
That was before all the lobbyists.
Yeah. So I thought that was I'd never heard that, but that's a great point.
Yes, it is. The other thing too, is that, some of the vaccines that they give, like the hip vaccine,
mm-hmm.
And then also the FDA, now has Hep B, which they insist on giving to children. Upon birth, before they even leave the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that, they're not going to, very few people are, are even at risk for getting.
I was actually thinking as Dr. Kelly was speaking, I was actually thinking of the hepatitis B vaccine. So I'm glad you brought it up. For that reason, I mean, my thought was that, you know, any of your listeners who are thinking, you know, that the CDC's recommended schedule is based on science. Well, I would ask them just look at the hepatitis B vaccine. Look at the fact that they recommend it to be routinely administered to children on the very first day of their lives. Like you said, before they even leave the hospital, they're getting the hepatitis B vaccine. Consider the fact that it's a sexually transmitted disease, or it's spread, you know, through shared needles.
Right.
So infants are not at risk unless the mother is a carrier, which they test for routinely. So doctors know whether the mother is a carrier or not.
Right.
And yet, regardless of whether the mother is a carrier or not, they're saying just vaccinate every single one of them. They don't know how long the duration of immunity is for that vaccine. I mean,
they say 7 years.
Yeah, it's unclear, but it's not that long. And in most likely by the time they're actually of an age where they might put themselves at risk for hepatitis B, they don't have immunity from the first day of their lives. That immunity is gone if they ever had it in the first place. And the other thing about the hepatitis B vaccine is that it's one of the aluminum containing vaccines. They use aluminum as what they call an adjuvant, which the purpose
right.
of adjuvant in a vaccine is to create a more inflammatory response, so that there's an increase in the antibody production. Because if they didn't include the aluminum in there with the antigen component from the hepatitis B, they wouldn't cause, you know, a level of antibody production high enough to be what, you know, the term protective, which is what they have to do to get licensure from the FDA. They just have to show that that the antibody levels get to a level that is considered protective, that it confers
right.
that antibody immunity. But again, you know, that's scientifically invalid because an antibody response is not the only kind of immunity. And so they're putting the aluminum in there just to be able to get the vaccines to market, because that's how they get the antibody response that they need. And although, of course, aluminum is a known neurotoxin, and it's known, you know, and the government likes, you know, public policy, apologists always claim that, well, the aluminum just passes harmlessly through the body, and it's not a risk. But of course, you know, vaccine, that's false, and studies show that actually aluminum from vaccines, is persistent. Certainly much of it is eliminated from the body, but not all of it. And it's persistent, and it's transported to the brain. In fact, immune cells can carry it through the blood-brain barrier right into the brain, where it accumulates, and is associated with all kinds of harms, you know, neurodegenerative diseases. This is a known neurotoxin, and they're injecting it into children and infants on the very first day of their lives, regardless of whether the mother is even a carrier for hepatitis B.
Right.
I just ask people, what is the scientific rationale for that policy? You know,
it's just a new market.
Who thinks that the CDC's recommendations are based on science? Well, just look at that.
It was through the assistance of the CDC that they okayed this vaccine for children, because Merck was looking for a new market. They needed more profits. And of course, we know that the difference between methylmercury and ethylmercury, methylmercury comes from fish, mm-hmm. and they tell pregnant women, don't eat a lot of fish, don't do this, don't do that. But then they want to give you a flu shot so that it goes directly into your bloodstream, whereas if you eat fish, your stomach acids and whatnot will take care of a lot of the dangers in methylmercury. Correct.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm glad you brought up the mercury, but just going back to the aluminum real quick on that issue. You know, the study that the CDC and FDA most heavily rely on to support the claim that the aluminum is harmless. You know, that's one of the things they do. They look at a study that compared. It looked at ingested aluminum, but you know, which is really scientific fraud, because the FDA, and this is an FDA study I'm talking about, the FDA knows perfectly well that, you know, less than 1% of the aluminum that's ingested is actually absorbed into the body.
Right.
Whereas 100% of the aluminum that's injected is absorbed, you know, it's in the tissue.
Right.
It's in the body.
In your brain.
And so, you know, that was a rodent study, and there's a lot of other flaws with that study, but I mean, it's just that point alone. It just invalidates their conclusion that, well, the aluminum is fine to inject into people.
And so it's the formaldehyde and the aborted fetal tissue and all the other stuff that they put in vaccines. It's not just aluminum and mercury. It's a lot of stuff that you wouldn't dream of injecting into your body. In fact, a friend of mine, I guess she was on Facebook or something, and somebody called the local poison control center and said, what if this woman gave her child the following ingredients, injected these following ingredients into her child? And the poison control said, well, she would be guilty of murder or some crime.
Child.
And yet it's done routinely at your doctor's office.
And the government's response, you know, of course, when you know, a lot of parents have the question, you know, well, you're telling us not to eat fish,
mm-hmm.
but it's okay to inject, or, you know, and obviously, you know, thimerosal, like I said before, has been removed from most childhood vaccines, but back at a time when they were, you know, when they were exceeding EPA's own guidelines for mercury exposure with the vaccine schedule, you know, and there's still to this day with the flu shot, they're telling parents, you know, well, you know, the kind of mercury that's in vaccines, unlike the kind that's in fish, isn't toxic. It's not harmful.
It's more so.
Sorry, there's no such thing as, you know, a form of mercury that's not toxic.
Right.
It's just not even so uncontroversial that, yeah, ethyl mercury, the form of vaccine, is a known neurotoxin. I mean, the IOM report that, you know, in 2004 that public policy advocates, you know, looked to because, it, you know, it concluded that, you know, the hypothesis that vaccine caused autism is, you know, unsupported by scientific evidence. And they always point to that study. What does that say about the mercury that's in vaccines? Well, it calls it a quote unquote known neurotoxin.
Right.
But here's the site, CDC is telling people, oh, don't worry about it. It's a different form. And so it's not, unlike the form in fish, it's not harmful.
Wow.
Just lying, just straight up lying to people. And that's the CDC. I mean, that's on their website. You go to the CDC's website right now and look up their pages about the mercury that's in vaccines. And that's what they'll say, that, well, the form is different. And so we don't need to worry about it.
In fact,
they say, well, because it's more rapidly eliminated from the body. And that's true to an extent, because it's true that it's more rapidly eliminated from the blood. However, the mercury, you know, from vaccines is persistent in the body,
mm-hmm.
and it can cross the blood. It can be transported through the blood-brain barrier, just like aluminum, and accumulates in the brain. And in fact, it accumulates more so than methylmercury in the brain.
Right.
Because it's converted into inorganic mercury in the brain, and so for whatever reason, I don't know the you know the biological mechanism for it, but for some reason, the methylmercury actually has an easier time being, you know, transported back out of the brain, where it can then, you know, be transported out of the body. Whereas the form of mercury that, you know, ethyl mercury becomes inorganic mercury once it's in the brain. So therefore it's more persistent and accumulates in the brain more so than methylmercury. So although, you know, it is true that, yeah, sure, it's eliminated from the blood more readily, but the idea that means that, well, we don't need to worry about it. It's just scientific fraud, and it's a lie.
Right. Absolutely. We have Mark in Philadelphia. Mark?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, welcome. Great. Thank you, Deanna, and thank you for your guests. It seems like he's compiled a lot of evidence, and don't we know by now that any of these organizations that are looking out for our better way of life or better health, the FDA, the CDC, it's a ploy, and they're here to destroy us, and people need to know that, and I mean declare it, like, out loud, and say no. So my question is, okay, and I may have missed part of the show, did you guys talk about how we can, I know that we, how we can opt out, and my understanding is that there was a deal about religious beliefs, and then there's a deal about maybe being a part of a tribal, connecting with a tribe, Native American tribe, where you can step out of the requirement to, you know, the enforcement of vaccines on us and our offspring. And what's the word on that, Deanna, and to your guest?
The exemptions. What exemptions do we have? Like in California, they no longer accept medical. What is it that they don't accept?
Yeah, they don't. They eliminated non-medical exemptions.
Right, which means if your philosophy or religion says you can't have a vaccine, too bad, you have to have one anyway.
Right, yeah. And, you know, in different, every, you know, I don't know other states. I mean, I pay attention to California a little bit just because it's, you know, that's kind of with the direction where the country is headed, and it's just, you know, a frightening example of the, you know, the assault on our right to informed consent.
Right. Now, you have a...
And then, you know, here we have a you know, we do have non-medical exemptions.
Right.
I personally homeschool. So that's
perfect. Wonderful.
But that's just not feasible for a lot of people, I understand.
Now, you recently wrote an article, Why You Can't Trust the CDC on Vaccines. It came out today on HealthNet News. Erin Elizabeth posted it on HealthNet News.
Yeah, HealthNet. Well, they republished it from Children's
right.
Health, which is Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s organization, Children's,
right.
Health, Children's Health Defense, which has been helping me kind of get the message out about, you know, I've been doing this series on the influenza vaccine, and they've been publishing adapted excerpts from that series of mine.
Perfect.
Yeah, and so Why You Can't Trust the CDC on Vaccines, and I really wanted to just emphasize that point in particular, because so many people have this view of the government, kind of like the gentleman was saying, you know, that they're out, that they're protecting us, and they're out, you know, to act in the best interest of public health. And I actually don't agree with the suggestion that, you know, that just necessarily sinister intent. There absolutely is sinister intent among certain individuals within that whole system. But I really think that most people, you know, disbelieve the propaganda. George W. Bush in the Iraq War. I believe Bush probably believed his own propaganda about that. And, so actually that's part of what the article talks about, is that, you know, no, like, conspiracy theory is required to explain how it can be that the CDC deceives people about vaccines, because that's one of the things that, you know, the media like to hammer on, is, you know, anyone who believes that, you know, anyone who questions public policy and thinks the CDC, you know, is, you know, not acting in the best interest of public health, you know, they're conspiracy theorists. That's one of the attacks that they have. And I just go through that article and explain how, you know, doesn't require conspiracy theory to explain it. In fact, I mean, there's studies in the medical literature. I was talking about this earlier about how, you know, how there's institutionalized biases within the scientific and medical establishment. And obviously when you have the government, you know, with public vaccine policy, you know, conspiring with the industry, collaborate with the industry to kind of skew the direction of science, well, that's going to have a huge impact on public health. And there's a lot of implications of that. And obviously there's a lot of corruption within the CDC, you know, and I mentioned the example of Julie Gerberding, who's the from 2002 to 2009. I don't remember exact years, but, and she left her CDC post as director of the CDC. To go work as president of Merck's vaccine division. And currently her position is basically head of Merck's propaganda division.
Right.
So she's head of their, you know, public communications department.
So it's a revolving door from the corporate world to the pharmaceutical industry. And, you mentioned, George H.W. Bush. When you go back and look at the Bush family's, influence, in the pharmaceutical industry, and even if you go back to when he was, governor of Texas, some of the things that he implemented, for Big Pharma, were evident, and I talk about it in my book. So he's deeply involved. He was deeply involved with the changes that occurred within Texas that were first tried in Texas, and then if it worked in Texas, well, it's going to work elsewhere. And that includes also using prisoners to test certain pharmaceutical drugs on, and just all kinds of corruption. So and people generally know that they're doing something bad when they're doing something bad. I believe that. I think
there's this kind of cognitive dissonance that you see where
right.
people believe, you know, they convince themselves that two completely contradictory things are true. And they're really convinced of that. I mean, they really tend to believe. And there's also something called confirmation bias, which is, you know, for example, if you're a public health, you know, you're a government official and you work in public health, and, you know, I mean, your job requirement is to do things like promote vaccines, and you're going to convince yourself that that's the best thing because, you know, people want to believe that they're good and they're doing good things, and that's how they perceive their role in the world. And so any information that they come across that kind of supports their own personal identity, they're going to accept that as being true. And anything that contradicts that, anything that suggests that, well, you know, what you're
sure.
doing possibly be harming people, people don't want to hear that. They don't want to process that. They don't want to even acknowledge that possibility. And so they just shut out any information that contradicts their point of view. And
right.
so I think this really goes a long way to explaining that the situation, without having to, you know, identify as some, you know, like grand conspiracy or something. So I think that's a really key point because the media, again, they use that as a talking point. You know, anyone who questions public policy is a conspiracy theorist. And, so I really emphasize that point in that article about, you know, like how can it be that the CDC does lie about people and misinform people about vaccines without there being some kind of conspiracy? And so I really explain, you know, a number of the reasons that to explain
right.
how that can be so.
Right. I'm reading it now. Very nice article. I posted it in the chat room. And you, as you indicate, there is corruption at the CDC, and why that is, and you bring up Julie Gerberding, and that is amazing. I think I mentioned her in my book too, but she did sell her shares in Merck worth over $2.3 million,
Yeah, it was a lucrative, lucrative thing for her.
And it certainly is about money for many people. It's definitely about money.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, let's take another caller. We have another caller, Sherry in, Kansas. Sherry?
Hi, y'all.
Hi.
Deanna and your guest, I believe it was even Betty Martini that mentioned this, that there's aspartame in some vaccines, and I can't imagine why it would be in there. Are either of you aware of that, and what are they using it for, an adjuvant or what?
She did mention that, yes.
I haven't heard that, so I don't recall ever coming across any information about aspartame in vaccines. But it's interesting, you were talking earlier about George H.W. Bush and his connection to the pharmaceutical industry, and actually it was Donald Rumsfeld.
Oh, yes.
You probably know more about that.
Aspartame fame.
But, I just was reminded of that.
Yes. Yes, he's the one that got that. He called in his, what did he say? He called in his, I guess he, people in Congress owed him something, and so he used that and got that passed. And he was, at the time, the president of the company that made aspartame. And so it's amazing how much, how aspartame is in so many things, including milk, some milk products, yogurt. It's in Ricola natural herb cough drops. You wouldn't think that would be the case, because it says they're natural and that they use the exact same recipe. It says, we're done. My gosh, we're done. Oh, my goodness. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for staying the whole program with me.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You were just a fabulous guest and so informative, and I thank you very much for being a guest. And good luck in warning people about the things that you're talking about. And bless your family and your son. And
thank
keep
you.
Homeschooling and doing the good things you're doing. Thank you so much.
Will do. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Chat with you next week.